Hello and welcome to The Brief Podcast, where we try to bring you context, analysis, and perspectives on current events and international affairs. I'm your host, Jim Clancy. Be sure to follow us if you like what you find here on YouTube, Spotify, or Apple Podcasts. The Biden administration has put forward a ceasefire deal for Gaza, despite public comments by Israel and Hamas that they support the offer. Ironing out differences and making amendments to that deal isn't working. The conflict continues and casualties among Palestinian civilians increase daily. There are many risks: a wider war, failing U.S. diplomacy, and shifting public sentiment. This war in Gaza has raised many questions. Joining us to help answer some of them is Norman Finkelstein, activist, political scientist, and educator. Norman Finkelstein, hello, and welcome to The Brief.
Thank you for having me.
I want to begin where we stand right now with President Biden's offer of a ceasefire that he laid out, the UN Security Council unanimously supporting it. At the same time, we see both sides, the Israelis and Hamas, indicating to us that they want to make changes in it. They may be reluctant. Nobody is sure the deal will go through. And so nothing right now is happening. Once again, we're left in limbo.
I don't think it's correct to allocate equal responsibility on both sides. First of all, when President Biden presented the plan, he presented it as an Israeli plan. He said this was Netanyahu's plan that he was presenting. Immediately as he stated that, the Israeli government repeatedly said they do not accept any plan that includes a ceasefire before Hamas is militarily defeated, and that Hamas would have no future role in Gaza. So on that side, there was from the beginning a complete, not a partial, a complete disconnect between what Biden was saying and what Israel was saying. On the Palestinian side, I think there are two things to consider. Number one, Biden, by his own admission, was presenting Israel's plan. That's how he described it. So it seems to me that Hamas has a right to express concerns or a desire for some modifications to a plan which was presented as having been written by Israel. So beyond that, there has been some areas of disagreement about what Hamas has actually said. Hamas has been emphatic that it accepts the Biden plan, apparently with some modifications. Whether they're substantial or not, I can't say because I haven't seen what Hamas has presented to the negotiators. Now, there's a separate issue. The separate issue is not the plan itself, but what are its prospects? And that's independent of what the three parties to it have to say, what Israel has to say, what Hamas has to say, what the United States has to say. That's one side. The second side is, based on historical experience, what are the prospects for this plan? In my opinion, and I hate to sound like a Cassandra or a doomsday forecaster, I see zero prospects for the plan. I don't say that gleefully. Of course, one would want at any cost to see the suffering of the people of Gaza mitigated. But this plan reminded me, when I started to read it, it reminded me of, for those of you, most of your viewers will have no recollection whatsoever, but I think it was in 2002, but I can't say for sure, or maybe a little later, President Bush presented what was called a roadmap to peace. And as you've noticed, they've been calling this plan a roadmap. Now, what happened to that original roadmap to peace? Of course, nobody remembers it except those who specialize in the area. Israel accepted the plan. It was under Ariel Sharon when he was prime minister. Israel formally accepted the plan and then proceeded to enter qualifications which effectively nullified the plan. So they were technically on record as supporting it, but then they said, we don't accept Clause 1, we don't accept Clause 2, we don't accept Clause 3. And actually, Jimmy Carter, in his book called Peace Not Apartheid, at the very end, he analyzes the Israeli systematic repudiation, rejection of the plan that it accepted formally. And I think the same thing is going to happen here. Anybody who has any historic knowledge of the conflict knows that Israel accepts ceasefires, and then it's very adept at provoking reactions from the other side when it wants to break the ceasefire. So I attach, based on the historic record, I attach zero value to Israel's commitment to upholding a ceasefire. It upholds the ceasefire until it's ready for another attack, and then it starts the provocations. We know that from February 1955, when it wanted to provoke Abdel Nasser into war. We know that from May 1967, when it wanted to provoke a war in Lebanon. We know that from June 2008, when it wanted to provoke a war with Hamas in Gaza. It always has, as I said, it's very skillful. It's very adept at breaking the ceasefires. So that also makes me very skeptical of any plan based on a ceasefire. Now, you might say, and it's completely legitimate, but Professor Finkelstein, if you can't present a plan with a ceasefire, then how do you resolve this? And I admit that's a tough question. If I were the negotiator and I had the power to impose my will, I would support probably a full Israeli withdrawal from Gaza and a peacekeeping force along the border between Gaza and Israel. Now, as you know, Israel will never accept that. It will never accept the peacekeeping force for a very simple reason. A peacekeeping force is an impediment to provoking a new conflict when it's ready to provoke a new conflict. So it will never accept the peacekeeping force. And there's a second problem. We have to be honest about the fact that we're at a very nebulous moment. Let's say we want, as you know, I think since October 7th, more than 500 Palestinians have been killed in the West Bank. And there is a massive land grab going on in the West Bank. If there is a war with Hezbollah, which is not unlikely, if there is a war with Hezbollah, there's going to be a massive ethnic cleansing in the West Bank. There is no question whatsoever in my mind about that.
Let's talk about the party and their similar interests, because it occurs to me, or it appears, I should say, that Yahya Sinwar and Benjamin Netanyahu, their primary interest is preserving their position in power.
I don't really agree with that. First of all, I'll take it on both sides. I don't agree on both sides. First of all, there is no opposition either in the ruling elite or among the population in Israel about the desire to inflict a massive, irrevocable military defeat on Hamas. There's no disagreement about that. It's not just Netanyahu has an interest in preserving his power. The whole of the Israeli ruling elite, the whole of the Israeli establishment, and the whole of Israeli society. If you look at the polls, exactly as of the most recent poll, only 4% of Israeli Jewish society believes Israel is using too much force in Gaza. It's just 4%. Israel is a parliamentary system, which means that if you are strongly in disagreement with Netanyahu's policies in Gaza, you have the option of setting up a new party. And tiny parties in Israel actually wield power because of its parliamentary system. You see people like Gantz, people like, well, Lapid, all of them. They're disagreements, for sure. But there's no fundamental disagreement over wiping out Hamas and, as they've said, making sure this conflict is the last one, which is basically making Gaza unlivable and uninhabitable. That's what accounts for the massive destruction in Gaza, the mega deaths in Gaza. It's not because Hamas is using Palestinians as human shields. It's not because they're trying to uproot or explode the tunnel system. That's not the reason. The reason is very simple. The ultimate aim of this assault on Gaza is for once and for all to resolve this Gaza problem. And that means it tried in the first couple of weeks a massive ethnic cleansing, didn't work because the head of state of Egypt vetoed that idea. It spoke very clearly and unequivocally in genocidal terms, speaking of remember Amalek from the Bible, speaking of no food, water, fuel, or electricity will be allowed to enter a captive population in a concentration camp. That's a recipe. That is a recipe for genocide. That also had its obstacles. One of them being because of the pressures exerted on President Biden by the anti-genocide movement, he began pressuring Israel to admit humanitarian aid. Now, from October 7th to October 20th, the genocidal plan was in place. No food, fuel, water, or electricity was entering Gaza. Biden put the pressure, and some started to enter. But already by November, Human Rights Watch was saying that Israel is using starvation as a weapon of war. And by, that was November, it was only the second month, and it was already being said. By April, every UN official, was saying that Israel is using a man-made starvation or famine as a weapon of war. So that's a long way of saying, in answer to your question, I do not believe this is about Netanyahu, his fear of going to jail, the prospects of a new election. Were all that true, were it an individualized question of Biden, then you would have to ask a very simple question. Can you show me one single member, of the Israeli ruling elite who is condemning the genocidal assault on Gaza? Is there one? There is not one. I know. I've studied it very closely, and I follow it every day. And there's only 4% of the population, Jewish population, 4% of the Jewish Israeli population, who believes Israel is using too little force. And you'll be perhaps surprised to learn, fully 40% believe it's using too little force.
That's a very, very bleak picture with no way out. Because you seem to be saying, until and unless they succeed with this ethnic cleansing project. We can get hung up on terms here,
I agree with you.
but
Not
unless they succeed, it doesn't end.
well, I think it is very grim right now. I try to treat people like adults, and treating people like adults is not giving pep talks that you don't believe in. I think it's a very grim moment, and I do not believe Israel will let Hezbollah get away with what it did the past 6.5 months. About the estimates vary, but between 60 and 100,000 Israelis are still displaced in the north. And Hezbollah has made clear it will not relent until the assault in Gaza ends. And I don't think Israel, which it, the centerpiece of its strategic doctrine is what it calls deterrence capability. It's just a technical term. Every one of your viewers will understand it when I translate it into simple English. It means you have to maintain the Arab world's fear of you. That's their deterrence capability, that the Arab world is fearful of reacting to Israel. And Hezbollah has made clear it's not deterred.
Early on, President Biden sent warships and aircraft carriers to the Eastern Mediterranean as a way of trying to tamp down the possibility of a wider conflict. But it would seem, after a series of provocations and cross-border tit-for-tat attacks with missiles and rockets and drones, that we're edging closer to that confrontation.
We're very near. I've written on this subject. I think we're very near a terminal event, because the other side this time around, I have to say, on both sides, Israel is determined this is going to be the last conflict with Gaza. It used to speak of mowing the lawn in Gaza, and mowing the lawn meant periodically it carried on a high-tech murder spree in Gaza, beginning in, well, actually it goes back quite a long ways, but the things that people will most recently remember was Operation Cast Lead in 2008-9, then Operation Pillar of Defense 2012, then Operation Protective Edge 2014. These periodic high-tech murder sprees, called mowing the lawn. But after October 7th, Israel decided we're not mowing the lawn anymore. We're going to extirpate, which is the fancy word for pull out by the roots. We're going to extirpate every one of those 2.3 million blades of grass in Gaza. That's what we're going to do. It's no longer mowing the lawn. Now it's extirpating every one of those 2,300,000 blades of grass, half of whom, by the way, are children, in Gaza. That's the goal.
You put forward these views, which some see as, a realistic take on the situation, but others see as very disloyal as a Jew. I mean, it was only recently a rabbi famously called you a Jewish hater of Jews.
Look, facts aren't Jewish and facts aren't Gentile. Facts are facts. I'm presenting the factual record as I understand it, based on not a trivial amount of study. Based on, I started studying the conflict in June 1982, so we're talking about a track record now of 42 years. And I've written extensively on the topic. I think I can say with a reasonable amount of confidence that my academic record, so far as being faithful to the facts, the record is quite strong. Now, I will say that might be a minimal standard for people, but for me, it's an important standard. I think I do pride myself on factual accuracy. So, leaving aside that aspect, I don't think it's a question of whether you're Jewish or whether you're not Jewish, whether you're Jewish or whether you're Gentile. I think the critical question is, are you loyal? Are you faithful to truth? And are you faithful to justice? And those are my lodestars, and everything else I try. Everybody, of course, is susceptible to this or that personal prejudice, but you make a determined effort to fight the prejudice and contend with the facts as the record shows them.
I was there in the summer of 82 on the streets of West Beirut during Israel's attack on the PLO inside the city. And what I, you know, it was a different world for me. I began to see things in a different, when I looked at the facts on the ground, they didn't jibe with what I had learned about Israel, what I was being told about Israel, the whole, you know, the bent on this is the only democracy in the Middle East, that we're being forced to fight against these people. It's a really rough neighborhood. I saw, you know, things getting a lot worse because, precisely because of what the Israelis were doing.
Look, unfortunately, people have short memories on the one hand, and unfortunately, I'm an old man on the other hand. I remember in 1982. You realize, I suspect, that until October 7th, 2023, and the aftermath, the worst bloodletting by the Israelis was not in Gaza. It was Lebanon in June to September 1982. The estimates are about 18,000 to 20,000 Lebanese and Palestinians, overwhelmingly civilians, were killed during the Lebanon War. If you take the high points of Israel's murder sprees in Gaza, Operation Cast Lead, it was about 1,400 people killed. Operation Protective Edge, it was about 2,200 people killed. And then you compare it to Lebanon, it was 18,000 to 20,000 people killed, overwhelmingly in all cases, civilians.
So, and the reason for a lot of that was that the PLO had tunnels beneath West Beirut. They hid in those tunnels. I was there. And I can tell you that it was the Lebanese that paid the price. They were caught in the crossfire.
I'm not going to sing any praises to the PLO. I never had a particularly high regard for them. But I think that's totally, in my opinion, it's totally beside the point what you think of the PLO. The facts were very, very clear, because many Israelis wrote about it afterwards. The facts were very simple. The PLO had become too moderate. Yasser Arafat was openly calling for a two-state settlement, but a two-state settlement on the June 1967 border. Israel did not want to withdraw from the West Bank. And so, because of what, and I'll quote to you the senior Israeli historian on the topic, or political scientist, Avner Yaniv is his name, and he wrote an exhaustive book on the Lebanon War called Dilemmas of Security. He said because, and now I'm using his phrase, because of the PLO's peace offensive, Israel decided it had to eliminate the PLO, not because it wanted to destroy the state of Israel, not because it wanted to sweep the Jews into the sea, but because the PLO had become too moderate. And there had been a ceasefire. It was negotiated in July 1981 between Israel and the PLO. All accounts, bar none, I can even quote to you Abba Eben at the time. He said the northern border was quiet. All the accounts show that the PLO scrupulously upheld the ceasefire. It was Israel that provoked and provoked and provoked because it wanted a pretext to eliminate the PLO, not because it was too murderous or genocidal or anti-Semitic, but because it was too moderate, the PLO's peace offensive. And since you brought up the subject, that's why I'm skeptical about a ceasefire now, because I know how Israel carries on. It negotiates the ceasefires until the moment comes when it's ready to launch a new attack, and then it looks for the pretext, provokes the pretext, and attacks.
There isn't, as you've noted, there's not a force for peace in the political establishment anywhere to be found in Israel.
Correct.
Or in very small, dark corners. But what will they choose? Do they want to be a pariah state?
Look, they haven't felt the full effects of being a pariah state because of the United States. If the United States made them feel the full effects of a pariah state, you know the expression, I know which side my bread is being buttered. If they don't have the support of the U.S., they could rather quickly turn around, in my opinion. First of all, they couldn't have carried out the genocide the last 6 months without the U.S. weapons. That's just a fact. That's just a fact. So I don't believe that they have been compelled yet to feel the full effects of being a pariah state. Were they to feel those effects, knowing which side their bread is being buttered, or, in this case, no longer being buttered, I would say they might come around, so long as the solution that's being proposed to them is reasonable. Now, I will agree with you that if the solution being proposed to them appears totally unreasonable, they would probably fight to the last person. I think that's probably true. So the proposal has to be, on its face, reasonable. Now, I would say in this particular context, reasonable would be the proposal that has been on the table for literally four decades now. No, five decades now, since the early 1970s. Five decades now, namely the two states along the June 1967 border and a reasonable resolution of the refugee question. I think that's a reasonable solution. But since the last 6.5, coming on 7 months, I think it's correct to say that the legitimacy of Israel as a Jewish state has now been called into question, with many people doubting in the international community as well. As you will perhaps notice if you're sensitive to the language, now there's a lot of talk about 75, 76 years of Israeli injustice to the Palestinians, which means they're not going back to 67 now. If you count 76 years, they're going back to 48, which means questioning the legitimacy of the UN decision in 1947 to create two states in Palestine. And so I think there's a large amount of doubt now settling in as to whether it's possible to coexist with this Jewish supremacist state. And I've heard it from many reasonable people that they're now doubting, in light of the sheer insanity unleashed by Israel over the past 6.5 months, the magnitude of the lunacy that's now been on display if not in the mainstream media, then on the web. The lunacy, the madness, the complete loss of connection with reality by this
state. Well, that is what it would appear. That's what college students in the United States and then later in Europe, that's the message they seem to be saying. This is insane, and we're not going on with it.
Yeah, I'm not happy saying it, but I do believe you are correct. I think among the younger generation, the legitimacy and the sacrosanct nature of a Jewish state in the Middle East has now been called into question. I think that's correct. Do I think it's a good thing? I'm not sure. I have a very close friend, and he says that he's always supported the two states. He's Palestinian. But he says that the way the current Israeli state is constituted, it's simply not possible to live with it.
The situation does appear to be getting worse. I mean, this is the hardest, most extremist government ever elected to run this conflict.
Right, but I think we have to bear in mind the two prongs of what you just said. You said the most extremist government, but then you added ever elected. It's representative of Israeli society. We just can't get around that fact, or Jewish Israeli society. It is representative of that society. Now, I will admit, many countries go through periods of sheer insanity. I think Germany during World War II, I think Japan during World War II, went through paroxysms of lunacy. In particular, Germany beginning in 43, and the same thing with the Japanese. I mean, people forget the Japanese killed about 25 million Chinese. I mean, they were not second to the Nazis. They really were not. So, but then, as you know, after World War II, they became quite decent, until recently with Germany, quite decent humane societies. So I recognize societies can also change. And remember, our own country, it took a civil war in which, you know, people forget, the estimates are now, I was surprised because they've risen now, the figures I see, 700,000 Americans were killed. There's nothing comparable to that any time in American history. You know, you take World War II, the estimates are about 250,000 Americans were killed. In their own civil war, it was about three times that. Yeah, three times that. So even for ourselves to right a wrong in our own country, it took a massive amount of very brutal fraternal death.
Assume that Israelis want, you know, the government, the homeland safety that it might provide. When it was founded, there was that hope among Israelis. And it wasn't easy to achieve because there was so much opposition from the Arab world at the establishment of Israel. At the same time, will they ever return to that aspiration, or how are they encouraged to return to that kind of an aspiration where, you know, a light unto all other nations? That was the hope.
Right. Well, first of all, I don't like the idea of light unto all nations because it has this notion of superiority built into it. And I find those notions easily become racist, chauvinist, and so forth. Just be a normal nation. You know, for me, that's fine. You don't have to be a light unto nations, just be a normal nation. Where Israeli society is now, I don't know. I'll be honest with you. I don't, you know, sometimes people wonder, are my feelings torn between criticizing Israel on the one hand and it being a Jewish state on the other hand? And I have to say, maybe 30 years ago, that would be the case. But for me, and I'm going to, if you don't mind, I'll end it on this note. For me, Israel is not recognizably Jewish. Now, you might be perplexed at that statement, so I'll just tell you my explanation. Being Jewish meant very specific things when I was growing up. It meant investing a lot in academic achievement. That was being Jewish. It meant being liberal, or even more than liberal, on social issues. It meant being sensitive to issues like civil rights, sensitive to issues like oppression of ethnic groups, racial groups. A Jew for us, growing up, and you're roughly of my age cohort if you were in Lebanon in 1982, a Jew for us was somebody like, of course, Einstein, you know, the intellectual achievement. It meant creativity. For us, my generation, the paradigmatic Jew was, of course, Woody Allen. The horn-rimmed glasses, scrawny of his constitutional beauty, scrawny, being a little bit eccentric, creative. You know, that was a Jew. Israelis, what do you want me to tell you? They're monsters. When you read about how they conduct themselves in these conflicts, the glee and joy they derive from blowing up people's homes, how they posted on all the social media as they gleefully, and I don't mean just after October 7th, go back and read the compendium called By Breaking the Silence, the Israeli organization documenting how soldiers carry on during Israeli those killing sprees called operations. You look at their collection called How We Fought, and that was for the Protective Edge in 2014. It's the same mentality. How could you be gleeful at blowing up the homes of a population, 70% of whom are refugees or their descendants, people who were expelled in 1948, half of whom are children? How could you now be inflicting a human-made famine on a population that's one half children? The people outside Gaza who are blocking humanitarian trucks from getting in, half the population are children. That, to me, is unrecognizable as a Jew. So for me, those are Israelis. They're not Jews. Israel is the most admired state in the world by the far right. You understand that? By a Bolsonaro in Brazil, by an Orban in Hungary. the far right, which historically has been the seedbed of anti-Semitism, they admire the state of Israel because they don't see it as a Jewish state. They see it as a white supremacist state where the whites just happen to be Jewish. That's why the far right admires Israel. Israel's closest in its relations, just as it was very close to South Africa under the apartheid regime. Part of why the South Africans are going before the court over and over and over again, you know, part of it, of course, is sympathy for the people of Gaza. But part of it is, I believe, a settling of scores with that state, which broke all the boycotts of South Africa during the apartheid regime and cooperated with it. So for me, there's no conflict anymore because there's nothing recognizably Jewish as I, growing up, understood being Jewish. There's nothing recognizably Jewish in that state. It's completely and totally alien to me.
But is there, and a final question, is there a glimmer of hope here that people might, you know, transform, that they might change their ways, so to speak? And I think everybody has to be there. Everybody should support that. President Biden has put his whole election on the line.
Look, I totally agree with the possibility of people changing. But the question is how you get them to change. You will remember in our own civil rights movement, at the beginning of the transformations in the American South, at the beginning, they had to be imposed by force. Federal troops had to be brought in, and the South was forcibly desegregated. The civil rights movement forced the federal government to use force in order to desegregate the South. It was imposed from without. But I completely agree with you. In fundamental ways, the American South is a very different place. It is. A lot of black people, you know, they talk now about a reverse migration. There's many black people are going down south again. So can people change? Yes. But I don't believe it's going to come internally. I don't believe it would have come internally in Germany. I don't believe it would have come internally in Japan. And I don't believe it's going to come internally. I don't believe it would have come internally in the American South. If the American South had been left to its own devices, the federal government butt out, okay, and the whole North butt out, they would have just killed all the civil rights workers. They would have just been finished. There would have been no possibility. And they knew it. Why did the civil rights movement try to reach the North, try to reach the federal government, and also to reach the world, to embarrass the United States with the whole issue of segregation? You have to remember it was the middle of the Cold War, and the United States was saying it's a democracy versus totalitarianism, and the Soviet Union was saying, oh, really, democracy? Look at the American South. So part of it was to embarrass the American South. But within the American South, on its own, there's no possibility it would have desegregated. Just like there was no possibility, as I'm sure you understand, that the American South would have ended slavery were it not for the Civil War. We have to be realistic about those things. It took 700,000 Americans for the American South to end slavery. And it took the imposition of force from the outside the South in order to end Jim Crow in the American South. And I don't believe it's going to come from within Israel. I just look at the poll numbers. I look at the governments. No, it's not going to happen. The place is completely lunatic at this point. When you reach a point, there is a broad consensus to starve a civilian population, half of whom are children, you've lost your mind. You hear me? You have lost your mind. One half of the people in Gaza are children.
We're going to leave it there. Professor, I would say that it's been great talking with you, but your reality, it's not a very pretty one. It's not a very happy one. But it is, as I say, the reality of the situation. Norman Finkelstein, thanks so much for being with us and sharing your views and unique perspective here. We've got a long, hard road ahead.
And thank you for having me. I didn't realize you were a veteran of 1982, which means you see the world through a completely different lens. Most people have completely forgotten that. I want to just end on one note. Because I don't want to misrepresent myself. I don't claim mine to be a Jewish perspective. I would say, speaking as a person who is Jewish, I don't find anything in Israel, as I understood it growing up, being Jewish, I don't find anything Jewish in Israel. It's a completely alien entity to my moral universe, my intellectual universe, my family universe. The idea that a population would reach a consensus to starve another population, half of whom is children, starve them to death. Not Jewish. As I understood it.
And we hope you enjoyed this discussion with Norman Finkelstein. And we invite you to sample other editions that are available here on YouTube or on Spotify or Apple Podcasts. Give us a like, a follow, or subscribe. Again, thanks. I'm Jim Clancy, and you've been briefed.